This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to start with a little quiz. I'm going to play an early recording by a band I'm certain you know. See if you can guess who it is. Okay, let's see if you got it right. That's the Beatles, recorded at a rehearsal in Paul McCartney's home in 1960. Ringo hadn't joined the band yet, and Stuart Sutcliffe played bass. In 1960, the same year this recording was made, the Beatles went to Hamburg, Germany. One of the young people who saw them there was forever changed by the experience. She was a photographer named Astrid Kircher. She took some now classic photos of the band. She also gave a couple of the Beatles their now famous mop-top haircuts. And she and Stu Sutcliffe fell in love and got engaged. He was more of a painter than a bass player, so he quit the band and stayed in Hamburg with Kircher. But in 1962, Sutcliffe died of a brain hemorrhage. In 1964, after the Beatles had become an international sensation, Kircher accompanied her German photographer Max Scheller to London to take pictures of the Beatles on the set of A Hard Day's Night and to shoot them in their hometown, Liverpool. The photos Kircher and Scheller took are in the new book, Yesterday, The Beatles, Once Upon a Time. Astrid Kircher joins us from Hamburg. Astrid Kircher, welcome to Fresh Air. What led you to go hear the Beatles in the first place when they were performing in Hamburg where you lived?
Well, the first time I met the Beatles was to my former boyfriend, Klaus Voormann, who saw them one night when he was wandering around Hamburg. And then he heard this beautiful sound of rock and roll music, and he went down into a quite dark, filthy cellar where these boys were standing on a very, very tiny stage and performed in such a way that he was absolutely, let's call it, knocked out by the music and by their looks and everything around it. So he told me about it, and it took him a couple of days to convince me to go with him to see the boys, because the Reeper Barn is not a place where young ladies in the 50s or 60s were to have seen or go there. You know, it was not a nice place to go. But one night I just said, all right, I come with you. And so we went there, and when I went down the stairs and looked at the stage, I was just amazed how beautiful these boys looked. And being a photographer then, it was a photographer's dream. In fact, it was my dream, because I always thought I would like to take pictures of young boys who looked like them. So, and then when I heard the music, it was even more fantastic for me. So ever that first night, I went nearly every night to see them. And that's how it started.
You described the way they looked as being a photographer's dream, your dream. Would you describe how they looked the first time you saw the Beatles?
Well, they all had these, I don't know what you call the hairstyle, you know, like the rockers did in the 50s, like Marlon Brando, and with a lot of grease, and they have
the hair slicked back like a little pompadour.
Yes, you're right, and they wore really mad clothes, sort of not very clean, but unusual. Like John had a leather jacket on, and Stuart had a real proper suit jacket on. But they were so individual, every one of them, and tried to be stylish in their own little way, because then, as you have read before, they didn't have any money at all. So they made the best out what they had. And so John had a pair of jeans on, which he rolled up, which was very trendy then. And Stuart had a very, very pointed shoes. And so I've never seen anything like it before. So that was always my dream, to take pictures of people with character and a charisma. And there they were, all five of them looked absolutely wonderful.
Did you need their permission to start taking pictures of them?
Well, through my boyfriend Klaus, I asked them if they were willing that I can take the pictures, and they were just jumping up and down with joy. So one morning, because I only take pictures in daylight, we met on the corner of the Reeperbahn, and there they were all dressed up nicely and washed, and their hair was all shiny with the grease and everything. So I stuck them all in my little Volkswagen, and off we went to a fairground, which I thought was suited their image a lot, with all steel and rusted iron and lorries and things like that. So it took a whole morning from afternoon, and I took quite a lot of pictures. So that's where it started. And then I did the prints, and one night I went down to them to offer the prints to them, and they were absolutely delighted. They've never seen prints the size of 30 to 40 centimeters, which is quite large anyway. So after that, they began to trust me as a human being, not just as a pretty girl, which was very nice of them. And in fact, then we started talking to one another, and they accepted me as being an intelligent individual, which they could talk to, not only look and make funny jokes.
A fellow artist.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
Now, I think I'm looking at one of the photos from the session that you just described. They're seated on like a metal frame of, I don't know if it's a building or a car, and it's labeled Hugo Haas Hanover. What are they sitting on? And then maybe you could describe this pose.
Well, it is a lorry where the people from the fairground transport their equipment with. And of course, there are a lot of big iron things where they do their carousels and things. So that is where they are sitting on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have it's such a nice pose. I mean, there is because it's like an iron frame, there's like four separate parts of the frame, and each of the beetles is posed within one part of it. Several, two of them are standing, three of them are sitting on the frame. Paul's holding his. Everybody is actually holding their instrument.
Yeah.
And Pete Best is standing in front of his drum kit, and it's a really cool looking shot. Yeah. How did they feel about you posing them? Because this looks posed. It looks like you said you sit here, you sit there.
Yes. Well, you know, as I said, told you before, my English wasn't very good then. So I just went over and grabbed their heads and put them in the direction I wanted them to look. And I told them to sit up there and hold the instrument. And so it was a real sort of, it was a composition, you know, of people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A very attractive people.
Yeah.
So had you seen a lot of rock and roll photographs before this? I mean, your photographs of the Beatles ended up being very influential on subsequent rock and roll photographs. But what had you seen that influenced the way you shot then? Had you seen anything like that?
No, I didn't. Well, you know, at the beginning of the 60s, rock and roll just came to Germany in form of Bill Haley or Johnny Mathis, you can't call a rock and roller, but that is all we had. And I went in Hamburg to a concert of Bill Haley, which I thought was absolutely amazing. And then not to forget Elvis, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, but there weren't any magazines or rock and roll magazines, for example. I haven't seen any real good pictures of people like, like the rock and roll stars from America. So the only pictures I saw of rock and roll stars was Elvis on a cover, or it was Bill Haley. But I never liked those pictures because they were not what they present. You know, rock and roll to me is harsh and sometimes sentimental, and it needs a lot of intelligence and, of course, an awful lot of good looks.
Now, you describe when you first met the Beatles that their hair was greased back.
Yeah.
How did you change their hair, and why did you change it?
Well, my boyfriend Klaus had a big problem, and because his ears used to stick out. But in any other way, he was the most beautiful boy the world has seen. So I thought, how can you get this to go, these big sticking out ears? And then I had the idea to just grow the hair over them, which he then did, and it looked absolutely beautiful. So when the boys saw Klaus, Stuart was the first one who said, oh, I would like to have that hairstyle. And because their hair was very long, I could do it in one night, so which I did, and Stuart was the first one who performed on stage with the so-called Beatles or Klaus haircut.
Yeah, I never heard it before referred to as the Klaus haircut.
Yeah.
So how did the other Beatles decide to pick up on the same style?
When they finished playing in Hamburg, they went back to Liverpool, and I visited Stuart there. And then George came up to me and said, could you please cut my hair like Stuart's? So I did that, and but the other two didn't want to know about it, John and Paul. And Pete couldn't have the hairstyle anyway because he had curly hair. So, well, George had beautiful hair, and it went absolutely great when I cut it for him, and he was all pleased. But a little bit later, John and Paul went to visit an old friend of ours, another German photographer called Jürgen Vollmer, which he used to live in Paris and was assistant to William Klein, a very famous photographer. And Paul and John visited Jürgen, and he persuaded them to have their hairstyle changed. And so they came back from Paris looking like the rest of the Beatles.
What other changes did you make or suggest to the Beatles about their look or their clothes, whatever?
Well, the fact is that Stuart was the same height as I am, and he could wear my clothes. So immediately when he moved in with me and my mother, he got hold of all my clothes, like leather pants, leather jackets, collarless jackets, and white shirts with big collars like in the old days, and waistcoats and big scarves and things like that. But when he first appeared to play with them in Hamburg again, he used to wear a suit of mine made out of corduroy in black, and it had no color. It was colorless. And John just couldn't stop laughing and said, oh, have you got your mom's jacket on? So that was the start of the colorless jacket, which later on it was copied all over the place. But in fact, I copied it from Pierre Cardin, in a Paris designer who I saw in a magazine or something, and I thought that was a fantastic idea.
Well, if John was making fun of Stu's jacket that didn't have lapels, how come he ended up wearing one himself? Like, what changed the attitude from mockery to I want one too?
Well, John was always a little bit sarcastic. So at first, even with the hairstyle, he couldn't stop laughing. But in the end, he just joined in. That was John. That was typical.
It's interesting that Stu Sutcliffe would wear your clothes, because most men wouldn't dream back then particularly of wearing their girlfriend's clothes. It would be more okay for a girlfriend to wear her boyfriend's clothes, but not vice versa.
Well, you know, Stuart was a very special person, and he was miles ahead of everybody, you know, as far as intelligent and artistic feelings are concerned. He was miles ahead. So I learned a lot from him. And because in the 60s, as you may know or read about, we had a very strange attitude towards being young, towards sex, towards everything, because it was still so short after the war, and we had this big burden to carry as far as our parents and as far as our country went through, you know, after the war.
Well, tell us a little bit about what it was like to be a teenager growing up in post-World War Germany.
Well, it was very hard, because it is hard to imagine now that there weren't any magazines. You couldn't buy any English authors or anything that came from America, like jeans or whatever. It was impossible. So we had to do our own clothes if we had weird ideas, like wearing long scarves like the French people did. You had to knit them yourself, or long sweaters you used to nick from your father, because they were miles too big, because you wanted to look like the Sartre people in France or in Paris, like Juliette Greco or other people. And I was very, very much influenced by the films of Jean Cocteau and by Sartre and everything that came out of France, because it was closer than America or England. And anyway, England was then told by the older generation of Germans, we're still our enemies.
Did that come between you and the Beatles at all, the sense that your countries had recently been enemies? Did that interfere at all in the relationship?
No, not in our relationship. Mm-hmm. But John used to make funny remarks of it from stage, because most of the youngsters couldn't speak English, because we didn't have English in school. At you know, in the beginning, when after the war we went to school, so he used to shout from stage, "We won the war, and you Krauts," and all that, you know, which most of the people didn't understand. But the English people, they just were furious with laughter.
So that's why he said it, because he knew the German people wouldn't understand.
Yeah, sure.
So, but I read that John used to call you and your friends Exes, short for existentialists.
Yeah.
Because of how you looked and what you were influenced by.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Did you get the joke at the time?
Yeah, well, we were called, even in Germany, the Exes.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. There were the Rockers and the Exes, and later on the Mods, and, you know, all kinds of names. So we were the Exes because we were just wearing black and wore these silly long scarves up to down to the floor, and wore beret caps and big capes, and like the Flicks in Paris. So we looked a bit weird, but we all thought it was great to be different.
You became engaged to Stu Sutcliffe, who at the time when you met him in 1960 was the bass player in the band. You seemed so taken by all of the Beatles. What special happened between you and Stu Sutcliffe? What was the bond that you had?
Well, it's very strange, and maybe it sounds sort of sentimental, but when I saw him for the first time, I knew that was my man. You know, he was and still is the love of my life, even though he's gone for such a long time. But I never ever, and I was married a couple of times, met another man who was so fascinating, so beautiful, and so soft well-mannered, you name it, and that he was. And so, such a gifted artist.
It seems to me you both lived in a very visual world. I mean, he was an artist who learned to play bass so he could be in the Beatles. And you, of course, you know, were a photographer, a very visual person. So even though you didn't speak each other's languages at first, he's English or German, it seems like you must have had this visual connection.
Yes, there was a sort of bond between us, because maybe I correct you there. Stuart just played in the band because John persuaded him to to be in the band. And the first painting Stuart sold, John persuaded him again to buy a bass for that, to be in his group. So actually all Stuart wanted was to become a good painter.
Why did John want him in the band? Why did John want him in the band so much, knowing that he didn't know how to play?
Well, because John always said when Paul was moaning about, you know, how Stuart didn't practice and all that, but John always said it doesn't matter, he looks good. He is rock and roll.
So you were engaged. What kind of life had you envisioned for yourselves together?
Well, when you're young, you just in love, and every day is so new and so fresh and so beautiful, you just don't think of the future. But Stuart was there very mature, and he thought he could become a teacher in art school in London. And so that was what he was planning, and then that we maybe go back to England, or he gets maybe he could teach in Germany.
He died. Stu Sutcliffe died of a brain hemorrhage after a series of excruciating headaches. When he was getting those headaches, did you think and did he think that they were a symptom of something very serious?
No, not at all, because I mean, when you're so young, or death doesn't occur to you at all. It is not, it's so far away. I mean, a 21-year-old boy, you never think that there's something very drastically happening to him.
So I think what happened is one day he collapsed.
Yeah, he collapsed a couple of times in school. And they brought him home, and the doctor came, and he got x-rays. And when you remember in the 60s, x-rays was the only thing you could see as far as brain surgery is concerned.
There weren't MRIs or
imaging nothing
yet.
Yeah. So, and then it went better for a short while. And then one day my mother phoned me at work and said, you've got to come home, and Stuart is not feeling well. They brought him home from school again. And that's the day he died.
You were with him in the ambulance when he died?
Yes.
You know, you said that death doesn't occur to you when you're young, but you had to deal with it. You must have been quite shocked.
Of course I was, but you know, all my friends helped me an awful lot, and first of all John did, you know, and George, the two of them.
How did they help you?
Well, John, you know, John had a very funny way of telling the people he loved what was going on. And one day he just said, you have got to decide if you want to live or die. There is no other question. And you think about that, and then we talk about it again. And George was just sweet, you know, the not like John in a harsh way, but the things that helped me was John.
So you made the decision to go on?
Yes.
And continued with your work as a photographer?
Yes.
What were you photographing when the Beatles went back to England and they were no longer your muse?
Well, you know, I was an assistant to a very famous German photographer, and he had a big studio where we did advertising pictures and portraits of famous musicians and things like that. You know, a real normal photo studio. So I worked there, and next to it, my boss let I could take pictures and develop them in his darkroom, which was absolutely great. So I just wandered around and took pictures of my friends and things like that. But the work was very, very hard, and so I didn't have the time to take a lot of pictures.
The photos in your new book, Yesterday, The Beatles Once Upon a Time, are from 1964 when they were shooting A Hard Day's Night. How did you end up with them when they were shooting that?
Well, the magazine Stern in Hamburg, maybe you know the magazine, the chief photographer there was a friend of a friend of mine. And so he knew that I was very close to the Beatles. And he asked me if I could sort of act as a door opener for him to take pictures of the Beatles. And because at that time, when they did A Hard Day's Night, Brian Epstein stopped all the press activities and no photos were allowed to be shot then. So I phoned George and, you know, George was always my sort of guardian angel and told him about it. And he said, OK, you can come over if they pay you for it. Otherwise, you can stay at home. So I went to the Stern and told them, and they gave me quite, for the 60s, quite a good amount of money. And then we went over and George sent a chauffeur. And they picked us up from the airport, and I stayed with George and Ringo then, at the time they were making the film. So, and then when we went to the movie and did all the shots of them acting and relaxing and having fun, after that we went to Liverpool to meet Ringo's father and mommy, and Georgie's mom and dad.
When you were in Liverpool, you or Max Scheller took a lot of photographs of teenagers dressing like the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And you're at a guitar shop where everybody seems to want to be.
crowds of people buying guitars.
And these are all shots of the kind of influence that the success of the Beatles and other British bands had on teenagers. And you even took an ad out in the paper. Describe what the ad said.
So we put an ad in the Liverpool Echo, and Max wanted to have all the little tiny bands, you know, even the very young bands, on that big place in Liverpool and take pictures. So he put an ad in the paper, and everybody was to get a pound or something. So we expected about 5 or 6 people there. But when we arrived there, it was amazing. There were at least 60, 80 bands, even 10, 12-year-olds. So that was fun to do that picture.
Did you get a chance to go to clubs in Liverpool? And was it interesting for you to compare what popular culture and teenagerdom was like in Liverpool compared to what you had experienced in Hamburg?
Well, the only place I went to in Liverpool was the Cavern, which I thought was absolutely fantastic.
That's a club. Why don't you describe it?
Well, it is. If you look in the book, there is pictures of people standing in a row to go into something, and that is the Cavern Club. And I think it used to be old wine cellars where they used to have the wine, you know, the big barrels of wine. And they had a little stage. It was very low and very narrow. So they had lunchtime sessions for little kids, which went from, I think, 12 o'clock till 2. And that was the most amazing time because the bands were about 12, 13, 14 years old or even younger. And the crowds were even younger too. So I took some great pictures of kids in there.
Are you still taking photographs?
No.
Why not?
No, because, you know, when all these Beatle thing was going on, nobody was interested in my other work. No one at all. They just said, yeah, great, great. Where are the Beatles pictures? And so I wasn't sure if I'm really good or is it just the Beatles that made me sort of in a way famous? And I wasn't sure anymore if I'm good or not. So I just gave it up. That's it.
What did you do instead?
Well, I was always an assistant to a photographer for another 20 or 30 years. And then I started interior design, and I just did things which I liked to do, you know, which had at least fun.
Just one last question. I'm kind of curious. How do you dress now? What's your look now?
Still in black, and I've got very short hair. Uh-huh. Still like to wear leather pants. Even I'm going to be 70 next year. And, I try my best to look okay, you know.
Still into long scarves?
Yeah, a little bit. But that is because they're fashionable again. I wouldn't wear them if they weren't fashionable.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was lovely talking to you. Thank you very much.
Astrid Kecher spoke to us from Hamburg, Germany. Some of her 1964 photos are included in the new book, Yesterday, The Beatles Once Upon a Time. It's not often that you hear of a record company being destroyed by success, but that was the fate of one of America's most prominent blues, jazz, and soul labels, VJ Records. The music they recorded fell victim to legal problems after the label's collapse and has been unavailable for years. But now VJ has started a reissue program with Shout Factory Records. And today, rock historian Ed Ward looks at the four-disc box they've assembled, which charts the rise and fall of this one-time giant.
In 1953, Vivian Carter Bracken and her husband James borrowed $500 from a pawnbroker because they wanted to record a group they'd found in Gary, Indiana, where they owned a record store. They took their initials, V and J, and VJ Records was born. Right away, they had success, so much so that they had to lease the record, Baby It's You by the Spaniels, to another label for distribution. But it was a top 10 hit, and by the time the group's second record came out a year later, the Brackens were on firmer financial ground and had a crossover hit on their hands.
Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go home. Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go home.
I hate to leave you, but I really must.
Naturally, this attracted attention, so when a Chicago slaughterhouse worker named Jimmy Reed walked into their store asking to be recorded after being turned down by Chess, the biggest blues label in town, they did a session with him. The first record they put out by him went nowhere, but the second one was a top 10 R&B hit. With that, VJ was on the map. Another doo-wop group, the Eldorados, took off soon afterwards with At My Front Door, also known as Crazy Little Mama, which was a top 10 crossover hit, and the Brackens moved their operation to Chicago. As it turned out, there was talent all over the place, and Chess, which was located just across the street from VJ for a while, wasn't taking it all by any means. Perhaps because Vivian had a radio background, she was able to get Ewart Abner, Chicago's top promotion man, to join her team. Convincing her brother, Calvin Carter, to become the label's talent scout was probably a bit easier. While Chess continued to focus on blues, VJ knew that there was something new happening, and in 1958 they discovered a group that not only recorded a top 10 hit right out of the box, but became deeply associated with Chicago for the next 40 years, the Dells.
Oh,
And if the Dells were a harbinger of soul music, the other group they recorded that year was already making the transition. Jerry Butler and the Impressions soon went their separate ways, with Butler staying on to become another VJ hit machine. Not that the label gave up on classic doo-wop, recording one of the great cult masterpieces of the genre. Nobody's quite sure what Sheriff and the Ravels are singing on Shambalore, although there are references to chicken knees and Nazis along the way. VJ was also home to one of the last great doo-wop records, Duke of Earl, by Gene Chandler in 1961. By then, VJ was one of America's top labels, with a strong jazz catalog, some gospel groups, and Jerry Butler, Jimmy Reed, John Lee Hooker, and Betty Everett cranking out hit after hit. The first hint of disaster came in 1962 with their biggest record to date. Four Seasons hit so big that VJ found themselves without the money to pay for pressing more copies of their records, although they stumbled along for a while. The worst thing they could have done would be to sign another hit group, but they did. And what a group! Capitol Records had already passed on their option to release the Beatles in America, but the Brackens jumped at the chance. And Please Please Me and From Me to You both came out on VJ, followed by an album at the end of 1963. The Four Seasons and the Beatles both went to greener pastures, and VJ wound up in court, its day in the sun over.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He played music from VJ, the Definitive Collection, a boxed set of recordings from the catalog of VJ Records.